Welcome to Live Action Star Wars. I'm James.
I'm Ralph.
And today we are wrapping up our coverage of Light and Magic with part six, the best title of the season, I reckon. More pretending you're dinosaurs.
Right.
I think it's my favorite title because of the quote
and the story
of the context, yeah, that it comes up with. I'm sort of sad to see the end of this series. I'm excited that Andor's coming soon, but I'm really sad that this is the last part because I really, really enjoyed every episode of this.
I would like more of the earlier stuff. I think this episode was my least favorite. It was still great, but I think, again, we mentioned it last week. I feel like we get into DVD extras territory. And that's, I'm like, problem. I've seen this footage from the beginning, the making of episode one, mm-hmm. and all of that stuff. And I'm like, oh man, it's kind of a bummer because the stories are kind of, we knew these stories already.
Yeah. Especially like, I mean, Jurassic Park has some great features on various releases over the years. So we've seen all of that stuff. And this was very much like an episode in two halves. The first half being all Jurassic Park and the fact that changed the game again. Like there's been basically a game-changing moment almost every episode, but that one sort of set us off, and we've been saying it all along. That's what sort of set the computer graphics revolution, and that is now the standard. And it was there in 93 with that release that happened. And then the second half of the episode was George saying, cool, right, now I can do the prequels, and then prequels into Marvel and beyond, and then sort of touching on the volume and everything and how that's, quote unquote, changing it again. You know, that's the next latest.
My favorite thing is George being like, oh yeah, I thought about this years ago.
And yeah, like, I wanted to build this stage 25 years ago.
I would say he's probably correct. I'm assuming he's correct, but it's just funny that, you know, you go from George saying, I don't know how to operate a computer, I don't know how to operate my phone, and then just like being like, oh yeah, I wanted this to happen.
But when you hear about the fact that they had, like, what, 100 hours of Star Wars Underworld written, the TV show that he wanted to do after episode 3, and it was just a case of getting the technology to a point where it could be done on a TV budget. And it's like,
let him do it.
Now you could, but I think a lot of that stuff has been sort of reworked and reshuffled and changed up and stuff, but I mean,
I'd rather see that than the next prequel show.
Yeah, I mean, potentially. It depends on what they do. I think it would need to be reworked, but yeah. And then, like, I think that's the thing. When you see him coming on to set and seeing the volume and hearing him say, you need to see it. Because if you just see the quote of I wanted to build this 25 years ago, you see that on the page. If someone, like, if it was a magazine article or something, and that could be taken in so many different ways. Like, people would be like, oh, bitter old George Lucas, angry that he didn't get to do his thing. But it's not. He's glad for everyone involved.
There was an interview with John Williams this week, and the headlines were John Williams wants to do the next Bond score. So I'm like, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
But if you go and look at the actual interview, the interviewer asked her, did you ever want to do James Bond music? And he said, yeah, I'd love to do a James Bond score. Yeah.
Yeah.
And all the headlines were, Man, it's a little bit rough.
I mean, it's news, isn't it? It's always the way they're selling their papers. They're selling their ad space on their website. But it is depressing when it's like, that is what grabs the attention of people. And that's what people glom onto. Whereas context is key with everything. It was nice to see George there, though, on set. I thought it was cool. It was a nice way to bookend the series as well.
Right.
To
end with Mando, I thought was interesting because we were talking about, realistic people.
Yeah.
But the volume is that next big jump. And
it is.
I mean, the whole thing where they started with compositing looked like shit, and now they had like this crazy new compositor and then the Pixar machine.
Yeah.
Doing like optical compositing or digital compositing, and George Lucas going into digital, shooting digital and compositing that way to make it look better. And then now to the point where you don't have to do the compositing.
I mean, even it's like just there. Ben Burtt, when talking about doing like episode one and stuff as the editor, was saying like it became less editing the film and more compositing. It was taking that take from Captain Panaka and putting it into this other shot with these other guys. Like it was compositing, but as editing, which is fascinating as well, because it's almost like a step that has been skipped in the discussion. Like I don't hear about that step too much, which is interesting. But yeah, as you said, like the volume is just doing it live. It's taking away a level of compositing by just having it there. And the fact that I think it's Kathy Kennedy says, normally the visual effects and stuff are the thing that come last, but when you're doing it this way around, they have to be done first.
Yeah. Which kind of forces you to, I mean, it's the same as storyboarding.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we have seen stuff in the Disney gallery where they're talking about being able to move stuff, add different assets, like in real time, as the director wants it. Like if the director doesn't like where a rock is,
it's still a digital file, but is manipulatable. Yeah. I think Rodriguez said when they were in the ramp up to Book of Boba Fett, he's like, for this sort of thing, I'm enjoying using the volume, but for my movies and stuff, I will still go with like blue green screen because I like shooting a plate and then having the option to do whatever I want with it in the background after the fact. He can play around. And it's two different tools. They're in the same category of stuff, but it's two different tool sets.
Right.
And I can see the benefit of both. It was super cool though. And it was weird seeing, like we're talking about the volume now. It's at the end of the episode, but we don't ever stick to any sort of time frame with these. Seeing how people sort of move on from things. It took years and it was all models and animation and then stop motion and then digital and blue screen and everything. And that became, it was the standard for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. We've had the volume now for 3 years and we're kind of already over it and looking for the next thing or going, oh, isn't it nice that Andor is going to be shot all without the volume? Is that exponential?
There's got to be some, right? Or is it not?
I think they've said that none of it. I don't know. I don't know if they mean like none of the big spectacle stuff or if they mean like straight up not been used at all. But I don't know if they've got one built over here yet. So, and they know Andor was like pretty much shot exclusively in the UK. So
it's such a cool thing. There's the story where they say like some producer, someone came into the volume and thought that they built a set. And I'm like, I don't know. I want to get in it. That's the thing is I want to see how it messes with your eye. Because I'm like, how you clearly are walking into, you see the back of the monitors when you're walking in, but
I thought he meant when he was seeing like dailies and stuff. I thought he was seeing footage
of someone walking in there. And I'm like,
it was the scene, with the Imperial, and he was the Cedar baby. I thought it was he'd seen like the dailies of that. He's like, I thought we weren't building sets. He's like, no. That the only thing that we built is like the desk and some boxes. Yeah,
right.
But then you see them stood in front of it as like the volume goes to hyperspace essentially, and it's like, I want to be stood there for that because that would be incredible.
Would you get dizzy? Would you?
Who knows? Like I'm in.
I feel like I'd be triggered somehow.
Yeah.
I feel like I'd want to be sitting for that because those guys are just standing there. I'm like, how?
Yeah.
How are you just standing?
And it's when you see them stood there as well. And it's like, it goes from just like the sort of the test like blank screen and then it just flicks on. You're instantly in that world. It's like, how is that not disorientating?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
It's weird, but it's super cool. And it's an amazing bit of kit, and I'm glad that we've got it. It does work, but we see the limits of it. I think Obi-Wan was the one where we all sort of started to see the limitations of it at the moment, but it's still so new. we should say hi to some people.
Yeah. Here, I'll do it. Sarah's here. Hi, Sarah. Dinner was good. Thank you. I got leftovers. Rick is here, and by the way, so like right now I told this to James, like last night my computer just completely took a dump, and I there's a lot of stuff going on with it, and I spent way too much time. I spent like almost 8 hours trying to fix up stuff, and I have 2 minutes left on migrating a large 375 megabyte or gigabyte file to my hard drive, and it's got 2 minutes left. And I missed dinner last night, and I was glad that.
If we lose Ralph, don't worry, I'll keep vamping until he comes back.
Yeah, I'll be able to pop back in, but it says about a minute, so we'll see.
We'll see
if I can start getting spinning wheels. Rick is here. Jeremy's here. Lucha Johnny, good morning. Stevie said they could have spent more time in between Jurassic Park and Mando. They sort of like talked about.
There was a couple of other
Jurassic
things.
Park. Casper. They talked about. Yeah, a little weird. Of all the things, Casper. Yeah. And then the prequels. But then they kind of went back and like showed some stuff from like Forrest Gump and things like that.
Yeah, sort of when it was relevant in the conversation, but not chronologically. So that the Forrest Gump jump was just like, oh, and now here's some stuff from Forrest Gump. Yeah. When actually like the CG work in that is really interesting because they talk about it and it's a case of all the different types of you can do the big spectacle stuff where everyone knows it's a visual effect, but hey, look how realistic we can make it. And then you do the subtle stuff in Forrest Gump where you're taking out someone's legs, you're putting in ping pong balls because there's no way that he's doing it that well, sort of thing. And it's the trick of the eye stuff that's oftentimes, I think, more impressive.
Right.
Because you just believe it without even thinking about it.
Right. Jeremy says they felt like they realized they were coming to the end of their TED Talk to rush to get everything to the end. We kind of had that suspicion, but I mean... Oh, sorry, my file... I just migrated.
Is it done? Is it done? Oh, good.
here, you go through the rest. You go through the rest of the name. I have one thing to do.
I think that's everyone. Oh, Scott D's here as well. Nice to see you, Scott D. Scott D, House of the Dragon are using their own volume, their own version of the volume. I think everyone sort of... The volume is what it seems like Lucasfilm are calling it in-house, with stagecraft being like the tool that everyone is now jumping onto it. But yeah, it's not going away. It's going to be the new thing, I think, that a lot of studios start building.
Yeah, I want to say the first film to use the volume or a version of the volume is the Tom Cruise film that Joseph Kaczynski directed called Oblivion. Mm.
Yes.
If you've seen that movie where his apartment's like kind of hovering in the clouds, mm-hmm. There's some great behind the scenes stuff on Oblivion. I rewatched Oblivion recently. I actually liked it more the second go.
Cool. I was a bit hit or miss on it, but I really do enjoy Joseph Kaczynski. And, you know, after watching Top Gun just the other night.
Yeah, that's what happened. I watched Top Gun and then I went and I popped on Oblivion and I'm like, yeah, I like Joseph Kaczynski.
There's some stuff there, yeah. Yeah, and you and I are both big fans of Tron Legacy.
Oh, I love Tron Legacy. He should do a Star Wars. But if he's only doing stuff with Tom Cruise now, I'm fine with Tom Cruise being in a Star Wars.
I don't know. Tom Cruise is one of the last real movie stars, and I love him for when he's in his... But he's too weird, I think. And I don't know if I like his level of control over a Star Wars.
I have strong opinions.
Mm.
And I don't want to bring him up here.
I think that's fair.
But no, I like Tom Cruise movies, and I'm 100% fine with Tom Cruise. I'll just say it. No, I won't say it. as far as his beliefs, I think they're just as valid as anybody else's beliefs.
And for his wackiness that he has done in the past, he doesn't seem to be someone who's trying to shove it down your throat. So that's a credit to anyone who believes in.
I don't seek out any Tom Cruise material other than like
the movies.
I love watching Mission Impossible. I just rewatched them all recently. Yeah. So I mean, in a good role, I could see Tom Cruise in a Star Wars movie.
I think there are a lot worse people who are a lot more vocal about how bad they are, and they get a pass because. Probably they're less of a big personality than Tom Cruise.
I mean, if you if you get Macquarie, what's his name?
Christopher Macquarie.
Christopher Macquarie. Mm-hmm. Make him an imperial spy and just do Mission Impossible and Star Wars. I would totally watch
it. I mean, I tweeted about it the other night when I watched Top Gun. I would be happy if they literally did shot for shot that entire movie. Just reskin it. Just put some aliens in some cockpits. Put Wedge.
All I thought about the entire movie.
And you don't need to change anything about the plot or anything. Like, yeah, just reskin it as Rogue Squadron. And
they don't even say who the bad guys are.
The enemy.
Yeah, and so
put me TIE fighters.
Stormtroopers, TIE fighters.
TIE fighters, some interceptors, the Mark Fives, like, there you go, done. So
it's made.
Yeah. Just, I mean, it's done. Just do it. Yeah. But yeah.
Jennifer Connelly is a Twi'lek, and sure, we're all good.
I mean, that's it. You could have Hera. John Hamm could be Wedge if depending on when they said it. I think you have either Wedge as Maverick or as John Hamm's character. It depends. It depends on where.
This is what we do. Let's make it in 10 years.
Okay.
Wedge is John Hamm.
Mm-hmm.
And Poe Dameron is Maverick.
Yeah. He can't get out of the cockpit. He should be an admiral.
How have we not heard anything about Rogue Squadron? After Top Gun's like in the top 10 movies of all time.
Yeah. Like it's the highest grossing movie of the last like 3 years, isn't it?
It's on streaming now.
Yeah.
And it's like number 3 at the box office still.
Yeah. And it's wild. Last time that happened, I think, was Titanic.
Yeah. Guys, where's Rogue Squad? They have to be talking about it.
They have to.
Like, if Patty Jenkins can't do it, just get Bryce Dallas Howard.
Yeah. Just get it done. Just get it done.
Oh my God.
Jump on it. They have to be jumping on it.
Also, Warner Brothers, even though you're all jacked up, Green Lantern is a test pilot. Like, you get that going too?
Yeah, yeah. Again, script work is like, it's all just basically there. Just tweaks. That's all you need.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone would be mad about it. People would go, oh, they just made Top Gun again. But Top Gun was awesome, so we're just fine with that.
But you can make it even if it's like a not a team of like it's training montages. We can do training montages. It can be flight school into Top Gun. It could be literally anything.
Like I had it's like you could have Hobby and Tycho and Wes Jansen. They're all like the other crew that are like, they know Maverick. That Piggy, all of those guys, like they're the other crew that Maverick knows, like the older generation who are sort of like the flight deck people. Like that's all those guys. Just put them in there. Just put those names in there. You can recast them. You can put anyone in there. Just make it happen. That's the movie that I want more than anything.
I think I would want Poe Dameron.
I think Poe Dameron would be really good. Because, I mean, if you want to set it in between,
moving into the future,
push it forward. But if they wanted to set it in sort of the build up of the New Republic era, then Wedge is your Maverick. He should be an admiral, but he can't get out of the cockpit, sort of thing. Like he's just stuck in that way. But we've seen him now older, so let's go older. Let's just keep him going older into it.
Okay. So that's Rogue Squadron, and then
that's Rogue Squadron.
Rogue Squadron, give it to Kaczynski. And then have Christopher McQuarrie do the
spy movie,
the Tom Cruise in space.
Yeah. That'd be cool. Yeah. Jurassic Park really did change the game, though, didn't it? Everything. It still looks good. We talked about it a few weeks over the course of a few weeks. I liked getting the personal side of the behind the scenes with this episode. We know how the movie got made. We know a lot of that stuff. So seeing that the Phil Tippett of it all, and seeing his reaction, Phil Tippett just seems like the nicest person. And there was a sadness like in his eyes, even as he's talking about it, but also like was the way to go with it.
It's amazing. I could talk about this guy all day long. Yeah. So him mentioning stained glass, man, thumbs up. He said the water snake thing, like he kind of makes it a little bit dismissive
and the Terminator.
So like, he seems really dismissive, but you realize that's his headspace at the time.
Yeah.
Like, these aren't living, breathing things. He's creating living, breathing things.
And he's in the midst of building, like, real dinosaurs.
So, like, him seeing the test and saying, oh, shit, I'm extinct. And in his interview, just seeing him, like, defeated, and you're like, oh, poor Phil Tippett.
Just want to give him a hug.
Then, yeah. But then Spielberg's like, no, we need him. Or I don't know if Spielberg said it or if it was Dennis Muren.
Possibly both.
But they're like, they're animators, but they don't know
dinosaurs.
How dinosaurs move.
Yeah. And then it was like he went off, got sick, had pneumonia, and like couldn't get out of bed for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But then at the end of that, probably thinking, well, I'm out of the job.
Yeah.
And just getting that call from, you know, your best buddy in the world and the director that you probably have been working with and respect a lot at this time, just going, no, 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 you're not out of the job. We still need you. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And what's great about hearing his recollection of it and the state of his mind doing that, but then cutting to the footage of him on the set directing, talking about how the dinosaurs are moving around, being with the animators to show how they move and watching the animators and watching him get the new armature that's hooked to the computers. And he's just like, it's the most lively we've seen Phil Tippett ever.
Years,
he's just having fun. Cause
he's, like, he's still puppeteering, but he's puppeteering the, those
something
guys.
That looks real. He was accepting of the fact that, okay, the blurs can be digital because that's a thing he created was Go Motion.
Yeah.
He did that on Dragon Slayer where the stop motion, you do one frame every second, but when you shoot something, there's a blur in my hand when the motion is fast. And so he created a way to add that blur. And he's like, oh, well, I guess I don't have to add the blur. They can do it. Great.
Yeah.
Great. They can do the blur. But then to see a dinosaur on screen that looked pretty photo real, he's like, oh shit, I can't compete with this.
Yeah.
The movement and it's sad for him because he didn't know how to do all the mouse stuff.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, I'm screwed. But for him to realize, oh, now I get to tell them how they move and it'll look real.
Yeah.
And I'm the guy. Like they still need me.
He's the dinosaur whisperer. Like he's
God.
And
him holding that stick with the giant T-Rex head on it.
In the lobby, like the most iconic sort of thing is like, and he was the one basically animating it, even if it was just a stick, just to be like, no, it'll go here and then it'll move around and it'll throw him up there in this sort of motion. Yeah.
And what's great about that, and I think what holds up as far as the Jurassic Park effects is that, and I don't know if this happens now, it happened in episode one where you have the sort of visual effects supervisor.
Yeah.
On the set.
Yeah.
Directing with the director. Because Phil Tippett was next to Spielberg telling him how the shot can go and how they can make it look. Lucas was telling John Knoll what to do.
Yes.
This is how I'm doing it. And you got to make sure this happens. And you got to make sure this happens. And
it wasn't John Knoll wasn't
like, John Knoll was very like, you're crazy, but I guess I'll figure it out later. Instead of John Knoll being able to talk to George, because he's been a fan of George's whole life.
Of course, he's not going to
be able to say like, no, we can pan up like this. We'll get the shot. We'll look great if we do it up here and then pan down and do it like that. And so seeing the difference between Spielberg and Phil Tippett and John Knoll and George Lucas, because George Lucas doesn't know how to do any of this stuff.
Yeah.
So he's like, I want this to happen and I want this to happen. Where Spielberg's like, I'm a filmmaker. And Phil Tippett's like, I can create this. There's parameters here.
Yeah.
And if you want this done, this is going to be the most dynamic shot you're going to get by moving the camera here. And it's going to take this much time because his brain, Phil Tippett's brain, we've learned that it's in stop motion. His brain works in a sort of stop motion speed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, oh shit. sorry, I'm animated.
Phil Tippett's in the room.
So he can time out how long it'll take the dinosaur. Because the shot you see is they show him directing the T-Rex coming in.
Yeah.
And then panning down to like the raptors or mm-hmm. or the thing falling.
Yeah. The banner in front of the T-Rex. Yeah.
So seeing his excitement is like infectious.
It is.
This, and he, which is what I describe this whole series funny. As yeah. is infectious.
Yeah. This show and then you seeing him be the one who was suggesting, no, to be able to animate these guys, you as a team need to be able to move like dinosaurs. And yeah. so it was him saying, okay, cool. We're basically going to go do improv classes as dinosaurs. We're going to go run around in the car park as dinosaurs. And that just felt like the old days again. It felt like they're messing around in the car park at lunch in 76. It's,
well, what's fun is he turned the animator. So the animators for T2 would stand around and watch Robert Patrick in his underwear. Yeah. And they would study him and yeah. film him and watch him.
Because it's that's a human, different. You can do that.
That's different. That's a performance. But you need to get that same performance as these dinosaurs. So you need to go figure out what it's like to be these dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And you go film yourself doing it.
Yeah.
And you'll know like what it takes to get over that log.
And yeah, the effort put in. And like the shots, when you see that gang of them running over just the plastic.
It looks like it.
It's the shot. It's the same shot as in the movie. It's like, it's right there. And yeah, they've got the bounce to them. They've got all of that. And it's great. And it just made me go like, okay, cool. A lot of those people might have been there from the old days. They might have come in at various points. They might not be the people that were running around in the car park, but that same energy, that same feeling that the company has kept, clearly. But they're older now, so when they fall over, they break their animating arm, and then they're told no more running around in the car park like idiots.
Yeah. But it worked. It worked. I guarantee you that in Jurassic World Dominion, which I haven't seen.
I tried. We started trying to watch it last week.
I'm telling you, I bet you the animators are just basing it, the animals off of what they've seen in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Like there's a difference between animating. I took an animation class once for like a semester. And you can animate stuff, but there are definitely mirrors around for you to go and perform.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a much different headspace sitting at a computer and animating and than actual performing it. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to do it in your head and sit at a computer and animate. Or I was doing actual line drawings. It's really difficult to like do that mentally. Like you have to physically get up and do it to feel
have what you're doing. The reference. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's much easier to do it yourself than it is to watch somebody else.
Yeah, because you know exactly. Like, I mean, yeah. that's
become you know directing where, at you that know point. Where your weight is being dispersed. You know where it is a big thing. And it's funny that Phil Tippett knew that.
Yeah. Well, because he's done it on a smaller scale. He knows that to get the right motion, he's probably in his shop. He'll be stood back. He'll be like moving a little puppet. And then
I'm telling Stevie that the Spaz skeleton didn't move right. And I could tell it didn't move right.
It was
because the head bob and then there was the step, the head bob and the step. And I'm like, no, it would be the step and then the head bob. Mm. And that's what Phil Tippett brings.
Yeah.
Like you look at the skeleton, I'm sure they were like, oh, this is crazy. This is great. Whatever at the time.
Yeah.
But the performance needed that, you know, Spaz can go and make Ferrari engine parts and rebuild that stuff and create stuff and do some animation, but and figure out the math, like figuring out the legs or whatever.
And the way that he talks about like when they had to scan in the model and everything like that, he's like, and I just wrote this and I did this and that. Or when he's talking about the run and he's like, I wrote a little bit of code and slowed it down by 20%, and that's what made it work. That's what he can bring to it for sure. Like they've got the motion, but to get it to the right speed so it looks right in camera, he could do that.
And then the whole thing with Jurassic Park is it works because Stan Winston has these dinosaurs on set, and you know what the lighting looks like.
Yes,
you know the frame what the of reference version looks like.
Yeah,
so. You know, you're able to match it up.
Mm-hmm.
And it just looks so seamless. There's a bit in the beginning, the making of episode one, where when they were going to create Jar Jar, it was just going to be a head replacement. Mm-hmm. It was going to be Ahmed Best in the suit with head replacement. And the suit cost like $150,000 or something. And John Knoll shows George Lucas the Jar Jar with the head replacement versus a full CG Jar Jar next to it. And George says, "That's great, but I wasted $150,000 on the suit." But John Knoll says,
"You didn't waste it.
The suit is the perfect reference for us. We base the lighting off of the reference.
Yeah.
Like that suit is what's going to make the CG Jar Jar look like it's actually in the scene."
And that's afraid- why you don't take Ahmed Best out of the suit when you're filming the rest of it. It's like, no.
Right.
Keep him in that because we need that reference all the way through. Yeah.
And now you could do your digital editing where you're just pulling him out and putting in the digital one.
Exactly.
I think Jar Jar still looks good.
Yeah.
Say what you will about the character. I like the character. Again.
Like him a lot more. I like him a lot more now than I ever have previously.
Yeah.
In the last couple of years.
George being ahead of his time. It's always the case. But just the look of it. There's this one of the first shots of Jar Jar you see is when Qui-Gon tackles him and they're under the tank that's going over the head. The lighting on Jar Jar is so perfect.
Mm.
It's so perfect. And I have a feeling they really wanted to nail that shot because they needed to sell Jar Jar.
And it's a close up. It's your first like tight on him.
You're right on the skin. Yeah. The lighting matches Liam Neeson's perfectly.
Yeah.
He still looks good.
Mm.
He's animated cartoony. And so your brain is going, a man would fit in that costume. So it's a CG guy, but the more I watch it, the less I think of it as a cartoon and the less I think of it as a CG guy. And now I'm watching the whole frame and just Jar Jar just is there instead of me just being like, what is that thing that I've never seen before? So, I think they probably have some dinosaur heads on sticks for like the new Jurassic Park to get lighting references and stuff, but I don't know, man. I feel like you need a Stan Winston, you know, or a Phil Tippett to have a puppet performance on the set.
But that's the thing, like without Stan Winston himself, like, okay, sure. Stan Winston Studios, I think, are still involved with the Jurassic movies. But Phil Tippett, certainly isn't. It might get a thank you at the end in the credits, but
like, Phil Tippett in Jurassic Park gets a crazy credit. It's like
dinosaur
action. It's like dinosaur action directed by or created by
Phil Tippett. And we were discussing it in the build up to this where it was like there was it should have been Phil Tippett's movie. It became Dennis Muren's movie, but it really was a marriage of both of them. Like it really was. And it was hearing Dennis talk about it after the fact, and he's like, "Look, I like pushing the technology and stuff forward, but I was really didn't want it to like have a negative effect on my relationship with my best friend because you know, it is. And they say it when everyone's going through what Industrial Light and Magic means to them as the words. And it's like, it still is an industry. It still is.
Yeah.
It's a business.
Yeah.
And then everyone saying the same thing at the end of the Jurassic Park talk with, you know, when that came out, they all knew, and George knew, and they were all like, that is it. Like, that's the end of an era and a beginning of a new one. The model shop, were expecting the model shop to close up within the next sort of 2-3 years, and it happened within a matter of months, basically.
Well, it's nuts because, like, what was 11 years ago? 2012?
2011? Like, 2011,
yeah. So I associate that with, like, Green Lantern and Thor came out.
Yeah, it was the year before 11, Avengers. Yeah.
Yeah. So 11 years before Jurassic Park was Tron.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
82 to 93 is a huge jump in computer animation.
Yeah, that's like, wild.
They got everyone who could do computer-generated images and just freaking hyperspace.
Yeah.
Hyperspace. Like, Stained Glass Man was 3 years was that 85? Was 3 years after?
I think it was, yeah, I think they said
3 years after Tron, and that's a huge leap.
Yeah.
And then 4 years after that is Abyss.
Yeah.
And then two years, and then is T2, and then Jurassic Park is 2 years after that.
Two years later, we've got Toy Story, which is full.
Yeah.
You know, it's.
Yeah. And then 2 years later, Special Edition.
Yeah.
And Jabba doesn't look great. But
no, there's some
George was like, I want to do this. I want a Jurassic Park up Star Wars. So put a Ronto in there. We'll call it a Ronto. but it's one of those things where it's like, where it's like, this shit happened fast.
Yeah.
It happened real fast.
That's what I was saying with the volume and the exponential speed up. Like, as it starts to go, you go 11 years between Tron and Jurassic Park, but then you got 3 years, 2 years, 1 year, like, and now it's like 3 years from this brand new thing. And we're like, okay, cool. Well, I get it. I've seen it.
What's interesting about this, and I think it's kind of a misstep, so I'm putting Lawrence Kasdan on blast, is that episode one had the most model shots of any film ever.
Yep.
And it may still hold the record. And I'm surprised they didn't bring that up.
They talked about there would be times after Jurassic Park and stuff where they might not be working full time. It's like, it didn't go up. I said it earlier on that it closed up. It's like, no. It was a case of not every film is going to require as a full complement of models, but it still was there. And there were still people in the model shop.
It's kind of interesting. I could have probably used an eighth episode. It's kind of interesting that they didn't mention Young Indiana Jones Chronicles.
There's a lot that they sort of skimmed over. I mean,
which I feel like that was a testing ground. But I mean, Casper? Is Casper like...
My biggest thing with Casper is when they were talking about it, it was Roger Guyatt. That was when Roger Guyatt came into the picture, was with Casper.
Okay.
And last week when we saw the sort of montage of people talking about things, I thought that Roger Guyatt was... what's his name from Apple, or formerly of Apple? Johnny Ive. And it's not, it's just they've got a similar British accent. They've got both got bald head. And apparently they both like working on things that are like stark white. So I was just like, oh, okay, cool, right. Roger Guyatt isn't Johnny Ive, but I know Guyatt by name. Just because, again, he's ILM. But yeah, that was interesting. Like, yeah, I think the thing with Casper, what they were talking about, it was like twice the amount of screen time of CG shots than Jurassic Park, and it was only a year later.
Yeah.
It's again, it's that ramp up of everything.
But I want to say that Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, I believe, was George Lucas's proof of concept of what he could do with digital. And I know they did a lot of model work.
It was also like screen and model work. The Rick McCullen like coming in on there, wasn't it? That was when he joined. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause there's things like, Watto or the sort of pit, the pit area for, where they do the chance cubes.
Oh, yeah.
Watto does the chance cubes and stuff. Like, that's a model.
Yeah.
That's 100% green screen, them standing in a model.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that stuff I find fascinating. The digital compositing really works. Like, that stuff, you don't think... You're like, it might not be a set, it might be green screen, but it's a model, so it's real,
It is as you guys have said, and people in the comments are saying about like the things that they would have liked to have seen. It feels like, okay, they've got six episodes. They can tell a linear story, and it's a case of the progression of technology. But then you go to talk about the fact that the most models were used in episode one. And even when we were covering like episode three, like a lot of that, like the lava river was a model and everything as well. So it's like, they were still doing model stuff all the way through. They probably still are now. But
they did it in The Mandalorian.
Yeah. And I think that was just a, hey, look, we're still using old technology as well. And isn't it cool that John Knoll just comes in and builds this rig without anyone asking?
John Knoll doing his own Spaz Williams, I'm going to make a dinosaur skeleton.
Absolutely.
He's like, I'm making Star Wars. He just finished Rogue One.
Yeah.
That's the height, you've created a Star Wars story.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, where else do I go? He's like, I'm still working on Star Wars, but
he's still like got that engineering.
I want to be John Dykstra. I want to be one of those guys. And he's just like, he just goes and makes a motion control camera or a motion control rig.
Yeah.
Razor Crest and calls the model maker.
The Dykstra arm, isn't it? It's the equivalent of that. It's just making it himself. Spaz and Dupi, like, just doing the dinosaurs as an after-hours project. Yeah. You know, it's... Yeah. It's cool. It's nice seeing that. But, yeah, it would have almost, like, taken the narrative back a step to go, yeah, we can do all of this. But then we also made loads of models for episode one. But then the way that you could do that if they had more time would be the compositing of the two together, the merging of the old and the new. But again, we've got a lot of that stuff in the documentaries and all the other documentaries for each individual film.
Yeah. Favreau.
Yeah.
I like him.
I do.
He comes out good in this for me. I have issues. I have issues with him trying to make things cool.
He's very camera ready, I will say, about Favreau, and it comes from being an actor. I think he's always got the right thing to say.
Yeah. And the thing about this whole thing is, this made me want to watch Mandalorian. It made me want to watch Jurassic Park. Didn't make me want to watch Casper. I think that's why I didn't want it in there. Because this whole thing, I want to watch Raiders. I want to watch Star Wars. I want to watch
T2, Abyss.
T2, yeah. I want to watch all these things.
Yeah.
But I'm like, not Casper. But but just seeing like the shots from Mandalorian, and I'm like, oh, these are really good shots. But they're also talking about story, and I'm like, Mandalorian's story is kind of, I think the first season's kind of weak as far as, it feels more like proof of concept to me.
Yeah, there are
what kind of environments can we do?
Yeah,
let's see what he looks like walking around in this location.
I think we said it when we did our look back on season one. If you want to watch Mandalorian for the story, you only need to watch three episodes of that first season.
Favreau's maybe the first two episodes and the last two.
I think,
or not even the second episode.
I can't remember. It was something like that.
Yeah.
Well, it was like 1, 3. And 6 or something like that. I can't remember.
But yeah, this one was this made me really want to watch it.
It's just that opening shot of him coming through the door and the music and everything hitting. It's just like still cool. And it's the blessing and the curse. Cool. It's cool.
It's cool.
But again, I liked Fabs coming in being skeptical and like, he's like, I'm not really bothered about like computers and stuff like that and CG and stuff. And you look at the movies that he was making pre Iron Man, and they're low budget comedies akin to a Kevin Smith movie. Like, he's of that class. And then everything from Iron Man and being fooled by the suits and what is practical suit and
that's fun. CG.
And you know, like when they had them next to each other, I'm like, I can see it. But if you'll show me one and then show me another one, it would be a lot harder.
Right. But that's the same thing with Jar Jar, is seeing the side by side. Well, that's obvious, but it's fun. It's fun to sort of show the directors like,
but hey, listen, this is how it's going to look. Completely won over by all of it is very cool because he's then, it's the massive turnaround from going, I don't know if I'm he's a little bit skeptical about CG to now making basically full CG animated live action movies. That's what Disney have him tapped to. Like, he is their go-to guy to do the quote unquote live action remakes of all their classics.
Yeah.
It's cool. I think that's the best thing to do about. And I mean, him and Filoni, both of them, it's a big sigh. I love that they're around. I love that they're doing it. And I don't know if I'd pick anyone in their place, but there are times where you're like,
It's hard. It's hard because we've entered the era of fan films. And that's not like a derogatory, but J.J. Abrams, huge fan of Star Wars, Gareth Edwards, Ron Howard.
Ron Howard's sort of in the family, I feel.
Yeah. But like Favreau and Filoni and all these guys, even John Knoll.
Yep. We said it a couple, like,
Doug Chang, as they're you fans get of Star Wars.
Yeah.
And so now the farther you get away from George, it's people like Rian Johnson, who I've always wanted to make Star Wars. I've always played Star Wars toys and now I get to do it. I want to put everything I've ever wanted to see in a Star Wars movie that I into one movie. And so a lot of times you might lose sight of story because it's cool that you're doing Star Wars. I feel
sometimes, big fan of Last Jedi, but sometimes I can understand people's hesitations on it and things, and the subverting for the sake of subverting or whatever you want to do it. Whatever criticisms people want to like put on it, it's like, they're all valid. Anyone's criticism is valid as long as it's not just it's shit. Yeah. I don't like it. Like that's yeah.
The funny thing is all the subversive stuff is all the stuff I like.
Mm-hmm.
That's all the stuff I like. But then like Rian Johnson was like, I've always wanted to do like my own cantina, but I want to see a casino in Star Wars. And it's like, this is my one shot. And I'm like, oh boy, it's a little over. It's a little much. But that's the thing. You gotta get out of your head that you're making a Star Wars movie and just make a movie.
Good movie. Yeah.
Definitely. I think of all of them, all of the Disney era stuff, I think that Gareth Edwards had his sort of emotions in check. It felt like, and it might just be his style of doing it handheld.
Yeah.
It's not grand sweeping shots. It's not steady cam shots. And so I feel like he's more like, I feel like Rogue One feels like the most pure actual
Star Wars. It's and then like, of course, Disney with that film. Though, the difference is we don't know what was him and what was Tony Gilroy. Like,
I have a hunch,
but the two of them, they have a similar sort of style. There's a lot of handheld. There's a lot of, like, you can see why Gilroy came in. So we'll see. And I have a hunch.
Yeah. I feel like Gilroy mostly just took stuff away and trimmed it down.
Yeah, I think so. Tightened it up a little bit.
Yeah, I've heard that the sort of Gareth Edwards version was a bit longer, and based on the trailer we've seen that
based on Godzilla, like, you look at the difference between Monsters, his first film, and Godzilla, where he had basically a blank check to do whatever. And they're vastly different. Like, Monsters is a really tight, small, like, indie film. And then Monster and Godzilla, I really enjoy his Godzilla, but it's really like big, it's sprawling, and it's totally different to what I think a lot of people expected.
Yeah. I like the dirty Star Wars.
Yeah.
I like the handheld a little bit more. And
leads us
like,
nicely.
As much as I like Force Awakens, the steady cam shots through the hallways and stuff, that doesn't look like Star Wars. That's why I like Bryce Dallas Howard so much.
She's done great.
Her Star Wars action scenes are like perfect.
Mm-hmm.
They're in hallways.
I think it took a while because I didn't like her first episode of Mando. I think it's my least favorite in season one. But I think that one is mostly because we've seen that story in Star Wars like three different times in different shows and stuff. And in film, just in general. But her stuff in season two that's my favorite. It's the complete opposite. It's my favorite episode of that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so she'd be great. I do hope she gets
Rogue Squadron.
Yeah, I'd be fine.
I feel like at this point, if people just want Rogue Squadron, and I know they did the whole thing with Patty Jenkins, the video Pilot with her thing, on the roller skate, great. But hand it off to Bryce Dallas Howard.
If she's too busy, you don't want to fall into the trap of, like, you have Rian Johnson, you announce a trilogy of Rian Johnson movies, and then Netflix backs up a truck of money to him and says, here you go, let's make like however many Knives Out movies as you want. And he goes, cool, because I get to do whatever I want with them. And that's got to be appealing to a director, especially after Last Jedi. So I'd like to see what he does if he came back and did anything. I don't think they're ever going to happen now. But with Patty Jenkins, like, if Warner Brothers have locked her down to do like however many things, who knows with everything that's going on with Warner Brothers, what that entails. Maybe it will get an announcement Disney Plus Day or something that, hey, by the way, or D23, that Patty Jenkins is like, she's on track, like we're shooting Rogue Squadron next year, sort of thing. So,
I want Star Wars movies.
Mm.
Let's do a Star Wars movie every other year and maybe one show a year. Like, I need a little more space.
Yeah.
Like I said, this show and doing this 6 weeks instead of just all at once has been a nice break because we're not really focused on
I'd new say Star Wars. One animated, one live action, one movie, one special. I think that would be enough to tie people over, like whether it's one of the Lego specials or they do like a small, like short thing or something on Disney Plus. Because then you can basically advertise something quarterly. You've got something quarterly, like you do your show at one point in the year, you're animated over the summer, you're special for a holiday, and then a movie whenever they want to put that in, summer or at Christmas.
Late May
would be the one.
Speaking of Disney Plus and all this stuff,
yeah,
we have 2 weeks before Andor starts, and we're each going to have a pick.
Yep.
Somewhere in there is dropping that Obi-Wan Disney. It's not Disney Gallery. So
Obi-Wan behind the scenes doc.
Yeah, we may have to do like a bonus episode somewhere on an off day.
Yeah.
Before Andor starts, or when Andor starts, or whatever. So we'll figure that out. But you want to talk about next week?
I think we should. I don't have anything left for Light and Magic. I think we've taken our time. I'm really glad that we did take our time with it. We could have done it double episodes, but it's been such a nice, as we've said it for weeks now, it's been a summer break being able to talk about this and then just have a sort of a casual chat about other things and just the state of Star Wars. It's lovely. So
I'm going to make it, it easy on us next week.
All right.
I'm going to make it, cause we're going to have like 13 or like 10 weeks straight of,
I think it's 10 weeks because we get, oh no, maybe 9 weeks because we're getting three at once that first week. But then that first week is going to be like hell on us.
Well, we're going to do that. Yeah, we're going to do that on Thursday, right? Yeah. We're doing that on Thursday.
But are we doing all three? Cause I don't think.
Yeah, we're doing all three
in one day.
Yeah. Do you want to do, because they all, do you want to split them up? We'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out. I can't remember what I've got off.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
And also, we don't know how long these shows are.
No, I mean, I'm imagining 45.
Yeah.
Thereabouts. Yeah.
We'll see how it goes. I figured I'd take it easy on us. We're not going to have any homework.
Oh.
We're going to be doing a Data Link episode.
Okay, awesome.
And we will be discussing Portroids with Rick DeMint.
Hey, we're getting Rick back.
Finally doing it.
Yes, amazing.
Rick,
we've got no homework, but we do have homework. We've got to scan through an Instagram feed.
We're going to do that live on the show.
Oh, amazing. Oh, cool. No homework.
So we've talked about this before. We talked about Portroids. If you go and watch, if you're listening on here, go to YouTube at liveactionstarwars.com and check out our Galactic Star Cruiser episode with Rick. He does this project that's Portroids. He's been doing it for years.
That's so cool.
He'll take a Polaroid of a person, and that person will sign the bottom autograph. Hopefully, sign the bottom of that that Polaroid.
Yep.
He'll scan it and upload it to his website and Instagram at Portroids. And we mentioned back then, and we've mentioned this since the start of the show, that we've always wanted to bring Rick on to talk about just the Star Wars
stuff,
relevant portraits that he's taken of, you know, like Daisy Ridley and
everyone,
everybody. and it was one of those things where I'm like, okay, I'll just go find the ones that I'm interested in talking about and then we'll discuss it. Well, Rick went and created sw.portraits. I think that's what it is. Rick can correct me if I'm wrong, on Instagram. And if you go to sw.portraits, he's culled all the Star Wars ones into one feed. And so it'll be way easier for us to look at that. We're going to pop up the feed. We're going to have Rick here. We're going to go through the feed and we're going to pour through it and just like talk about like how he got the picture, when it was happening, when it happened, and
what it was, what they were there advertising or like promoting, where they were. Yeah, all of this.
And if they don't sign it, does that mean they're a jerk? Were they too busy?
If they left a little extra message, if they insisted that Rick be in the picture as well, because there's definitely some of the portraits there, whoever it is what have wanted that. So, yeah.
So it's going to be fun. Like, I highly recommend everybody go right now at Portroyds. I probably should have carried
Portroyds and sw.portroyds.
Yeah, do a little bit of a vamping here.
That's awesome. I'm really excited about that. I didn't know what Ralph mentioned that he had a guest lined up for next week. I wasn't sure what we were going to do, but that is very exciting. I'm looking forward to talking to Rick. There we go. That is Portroyds. And on Portroyds, you'll find a link to SW. But if not, it's just sw.portroyds.
Yeah. You're going to want to. If you see
Portroyds, you're definitely going to want to check
it out. Dude, the stuff that the people, presidents.
Yeah.
Anyone from presidents to this guy.
To Ralph.
Yeah.
I mean, Rick was, we'll probably talk about it next week, but Rick was in the UK not too long ago, and we were hoping to be able to, I'd be able to go down to Brighton to catch up with him. And I think he was going to do one for me as well, but I was working that day, unfortunately, so I couldn't make it, but.
He's got a picture of me at work.
yeah, but you work at the time we're working somewhere fun. Is that I don't think Rick wants to come to a power station and take a picture of me in a security office.
Right.
Not really that glamorous.
I'm so excited about this.
Not the glamorous photos are the ones that he's taking anyway. A lot of the photos are like in the rain, someone's got an umbrella up. It's great.
This is how much Rick is looking forward to this. He's
that much.
If I'm not mistaken, he's going to be on vacation.
Oh wow! Okay.
And he got the green light from his awesome wife. That it sounded like fun. It sounded more like while he's doing this, she's going to go out and be able to do her morning run and
have some
be alone away from Rick. I can't wait. Yeah. It's a long. This is like something we've talked about since like day one.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, so
Rick was on for, was it one of the Book of Boba Fett episodes?
Galactic Star Cruiser, I know that.
Was Galactic Star Cruiser, of course it was, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is a great, like, it's still making flights daily. Go check out that if you want to know about the Galactic Star Cruiser in Florida. Rick had nothing but good things to say about it. It was a really, really, really fun episode. He was our first Datalink episode. He's actually like the reason why we created Datalink.
Yeah, definitely. It
wasn't necessarily live action Star Wars. So for those of you that are listening to this on audio, you can only get those Datalink episodes in the video form at Live Action Star Wars on YouTube.
Yeah.
So make sure you're subscribed and all that stuff.
And we'll keep it a mystery what we're doing the week after, but that might be a regular episode. It might be a Datalink episode. But after that, at the end of September, is it somewhere near the end of September, is Andor season begins. And
Andor begins, if I'm not mistaken, Andor begins, either it begins, I think it begins on the anniversary of Lost.
It's that week. I think that's right. It's Wednesday, September 21st, I believe. Yeah.
And we'll figure out a recording schedule. So as long as you're,
it might need to be. It might need to be one per session. Just looking at when I'm working, but we could do it before the end of that weekend. We'll have all three up.
You'll see at the top of our YouTube channel.
Yeah,
when the episodes will drop and which ones. So, I have a ton of free space on my computer, so I could create all the artwork for each episode. what was crazy was, I took the original file that was on my computer and I dropped it into the trash while we were talking. And when I hit empty trash, it was just going like this.
Oh, wow.
Instead of a progress bar. And I'm like, oh boy, here we go. But now I have like 400 available gigs now. So I'm back to full capacity.
That's awesome.
It was quite a day.
I forgot. I told Ralph before we started the show, Ed, friend of the show, Ed was down at the weekend and gave me a very, very cool gift, something that he's had in a wardrobe for ages and kept on forgetting to give to me. It's too small for him, but too big for me. It's a very, very cool solo editorial team. Can you see that? I'm behind the thing.
Yeah.
The solo crew t-shirt that he got, and with the super catchy We Shot First little slogan on the back of it. He got that when he was working in post-production on Solo. So, yeah, super cool gift. It's too big for me to really wear, but it'll be on the back of this chair, so you might see it in the past.
We still haven't talked to him about that.
About Solo? No. I think he's still scared of the mouse coming, a sniper rifle, and taking him out.
I guess
We'll see. that's definitely not in reference to anything that we are all big fans of here. Thank you, Scott D, for that. So that is going to do it for Light and Magic. Our entire coverage of Light and Magic, our summer vacation, talking about some of Light and Magic.
Good job, Lawrence Kasdan.
Yeah, good documentary.
And if you like the music, which is okay, it's available on digital.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah. It was nice. It was nice getting those new themes. Cool. Right. Until next week, when we will be joined for a Datalink episode with Rick, talking about his Star Wars portraits. Don't give in to hate.
Celebrate the love.
Punch it.